Okay, I think we're going to get started. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming. I know it's kind of early. I just want to take a moment and say thanks to Sharon Milgram for speaking today on behalf of the FELCOM Career Development Subcommittee, and she's going to be giving a talk today about how to give effective job talks, both in academia and in other settings as well. So I'm just going to turn it over right now to Lori.
Good morning. Come on, good morning. My name is Lori Conlon. I'm the Director of the Office of Postdoctoral Services here at the NIH. I'm the one you get the emails from. I wanted to thank everybody for coming again and remind you, those of you who do have summer students, the OITE does have a grad student and professional school fair next week on July 10th. Make sure to send them all over to Natcher. They've got about 100 schools are coming to recruit them, so it's a good chance for them to get a good little exposure. So today is effective job searches. How many of you are ready to go on the job market today with a good talk? Good. Well, hopefully you can get a couple tips today to improve. I'm here to introduce for our departmental seminar today, Dr. Sharon Milgram. She received her BS degree in physical therapy from Temple back in 84, and she worked for 2 years in stroke rehab before returning to graduate school at Emory University. After completing her PhD, in the Department of Anatomy, Sharon went to go work with Dick Means and Betty Eppert in the Neuroscience Department at Hopkins, so not too far away from here, where she is currently a postdoctoral fellow. She's come today to apply for a job with our organization, and she's going to give us a talk on trafficking of the secretory granule associated enzyme, PAM. Sharon, welcome.
Can I have the first slide, please? So the title of my talk is Trafficking of the Secretory Granule Associated Enzyme, PAM, and I'm Sharon Milgram. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Neuropeptide Lab at Johns Hopkins University. So thank you for coming to my job talk, and it's really nice to be here. So I'm going to give you today an introduction to the secretory pathway in neuroendocrine cells, and I'm going to tell you a lot about peptide processing enzymes and why they're such important enzymes to consider. And I'll also give you an introduction to protein trafficking signals, and then I'll end that introduction with sort of convincing you that PAM, one of the enzymes that actually my postdoc is focused on, is an important one. I'm going to show you sort of the bulk of the data from my work in Dick and Betty's lab, focused on site-directed mutagenesis and in studying those mutants both in fibroblasts and in an endocrine cell line. And I'm going to talk, too, about some chimeric proteins that I think prove our point, and then I'll end with some discussion of how our work can apply.
Sharon, you're killing us. Cut. How many of you guys have been to seminars like that? You're all still awake. Did you bring your toothpicks? All right. Sharon, can we start again, this time perhaps for an effective job talk? So giving you tips and tools to make your job talk actually where people will listen, stand up, and hire you. Try again. Sharon Milgram, postdoc, trying again.
Thank you, everyone, for the invitation to come and talk with you about my work that I've done in the neuropeptide lab with Dick Maines and Betty Eiper. I've really had a great visit this morning. I had breakfast with the graduate students and postdoctoral fellows and really enjoyed myself. I'm excited about the next 2 days and having lots of conversation with you about my work and about your department and how I might fit in here. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come, and I especially thank the organizers for your help in getting me here. So this is actually an artist's rendition of the secretory pathway. It almost looks like it could come from a cell biology textbook. As you know, all cells have a constitutive secretory pathway, but specialized cells like neurons and endocrine cells and neuroendocrine cells have an additional pathway called the regulated pathway. And these two pathways diverge at the TGN, sort of shown here by this abstract painter who swears she had no idea what it was that she was painting. This is actually now an art piece of art hanging in our house that's called Golgi Stacks. So right here at the Trans-Golgi Network, the constitutive and regulatory pathways diverge, and all of the hormones and enzymes involved in making the hormones are targeted to the regulated pathway. And in fact, peptide processing is very unique to the regulated pathway. And the question that my research has focused on and the question that I want to talk with you today about is what are the signals that selectively target proteins to the regulated pathway? And you actually don't need to hear my job talk. So I'm going to stop there. And just very quickly, before we actually get into the discussion of what makes a good job talk, I want some people, someone certainly, even though it's Monday morning at 9 o'clock, we'll throw out some things. So what are the differences? What was your feeling in the first talk versus the second talk?
The tone of your voice.
The tone of my voice. I mean, in that first talk, you would think that I wish to be anywhere but there, right? What else?
Huh?
I immediately, in that second one, engaged the audience. Somebody over here yelled something. Same thing. So you felt like you were actually here having a conversation with me. How many people, some people in this room know me. People who don't know me, how many thought, oh, I can't believe I came to this in that first one. What a waste of my time. I would be much better off in the lab. Anyone? Yeah. Well, I felt the same way. How many of you have sat through seminars just like that first one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Too many. So, in fact, I was a lousy speaker when I started my postdoc, so much so that in a workshop that I went to, somebody told me that all I did was make jokes to avoid actually talking to the audience. So my point, and I think you could debate aspects of the way I give a talk, but in sort of general terms, I've come a long way and give a pretty good seminar. And the point of that is it's actually something you can learn. Okay, so it's very easy to go from that really nervous, awkward introduction that tells the audience make your shopping list, right? Use your hour wisely to do something else, to engage this person. I might actually like to hear what she has to say. All right, so the goal is to do that, engage the audience. Okay, that actually is the goal of a job talk. You have about 90 seconds to convince the audience that they want to listen, all right? And so everything that you do in those first 90 seconds matter. How many people noticed that I hovered over Lori's shoulder completely nervous and distracting during the first introduction, and I sat down in a chair for the second one, okay? So all the way from little things like that up to the slides, up to what to do is what we'll talk about today. I do not have a huge number of slides, so I can take questions during the talk. You should feel free to interrupt. If we go too slow and get behind, I'll probably put off some questions till the end. But please don't hesitate to stop me along the way. What we're going to do is talk about all kinds of job talks, not just academic job talks, not government job talks, not industry job talks. Because as I was putting this together, and as I was communicating back and forth with the FELCOM Career Development Committee, really became obvious that there are many general principles that apply to giving a good job talk. And rather than sort of going linearly, industry, government, academia, what I want to do is highlight those general principles and then talk about each of those principles from the unique perspective of, okay, I'm at Glaxo, I'm at UNC, I'm at Oberlin. Okay, I'm at the FDA. Okay, so we'll talk about generalities, and then we'll talk about differences. Those of you who want the details step-by-step of a particular type of job talk should come this fall when the OITE will run two job series, one on getting an academic job and one on getting an industry job. If you are sort of a couple years away from the search, that series is probably more in depth than you want. But for those of you who see jobs in the immediate future, you'll get much more depth and much more chance to practice and to talk with people about real strategies there. So this is more of an overview, and I hope that that's going to work for everyone. There are really just 7 simple rules to keep in mind. Each of these rules matters no matter where you interview, okay? So industry, academia, big research one university, small college, doesn't matter. These 7 simple rules are what you should come to as you think about your talk and as you prepare. All right, we're just going to go through each of them one by one. And the first one is know your audience. And that's a rule that I think applies to giving any type of good seminar, but it is particularly important when you give a job seminar, okay? You need to know who it is that is going to be in the audience, because although you might have the impression that the search committee makes this decision, the minute a job candidate finishes their seminar, everyone in the audience goes back to their office and sends either, boy, that was great, thanks a lot, you know, let's consider moving ahead with this candidate, I'm really enthusiastic, or they send an email to the host saying, boy, that person bombed, I can't wait till next week. There is a lot of buzz that can be generated by a great job talk, and everyone in the room can become your ambassador and advocate. At a Research One university or a university where where you are applying for a research intensive job, typically the audience is full of scientists. Deans, human resource people, they won't come. Okay? The people who will come are scientists, both within and outside your field. At a teaching institution or a university where you are being hired to do both research and a serious amount of teaching, you're going to find faculty both in your department and outside. So it is not uncommon if you interview for a biology job for the physics faculty to be there. Okay? So there'll be faculty in and outside of your department. In this case, there will be administrators there in all likelihood. Okay? An assistant dean, an associate dean, someone will be there, and they're really looking from the perspective of what does this person bring that's special and how good of a teacher is he or she. And they will certainly be in the audience. You'll meet with them also during the day, but they will definitely be in the audience. And finally, you will find many more students at a seminar at a teaching institution compared to a Research One university. Often the students are heavily encouraged to go and give feedback. And that's the case at a Research One university as well, but the emphasis on connecting with the students is different at a teaching institution. It would be better to talk more to the students than to the faculty, okay? And that's not often the case at a Research One university at a job interview. Although you want to involve the students and connect with the students, you're really talking more to all of the scientists in the audience. Finally, in industry, something that has surprised every one of my fellows in coming back was how many non-scientists were there. MBAs who were involved in marketing, human resource people who were involved in the hiring process, non-scientists who coordinated the finances for core facilities. And the scientists who come are very, very often outside your field. Okay, so you can be a biologist, and your audience can be computational biologists, physicists, synthetic chemists, people who haven't thought much about the area of your research. In addition, very often for an industry interview, you're not getting hired based on the work you've done as a fellow. You're getting hired based on the skills, transferable skills, and approaches that you've developed as a fellow. And so there could be no one in the audience who knows much about your particular area, in this case, for the example, peptide amidating enzymes. Okay, so in industry, you are talking probably to the broadest group. At a teaching university, somewhat less broad, and at a Research One university, probably the most focused of groups. Okay, that said, think carefully, because if you apply for a job at, say, a center, You apply for the Center of Vascular Biology at a university. That center has people in multiple departments. So even though you might think, well, everyone's a vascular biologist, some will be geneticists, some will be chemists, some will be physicians. So although you might think in an academic university it's very focused, that is not always the case. Okay, and I would say government follows very, very much what I'll talk about for R1, with that same idea that it's not as narrow as you think, but it is definitely a more focused audience. The people on the search committee who know your work, they're not the people you're talking to. The five experts in the audience, you want them there, you want them to be positive about your work, but you're really talking to everyone else. You are trying to convince everyone in the room that what you do is interesting and exciting. So remember in this case that the seminar should be directed to the outsiders, not to the point that you simplify things so much that you completely sort of insult people's scientific expertise, but you really want to connect as broadly as possible and talk with the outsiders in the room. And finally, it's easy to talk to the search committee, it's easy to talk to the chair, but everyone in the room matters. Okay, so at one job interview that I went to, I learned right at the last minute that they were interviewing applicants for graduate school. And this happened to be a department that cared a lot about teaching. They took very seriously the teaching awards that they won in the department. And I realized there were these 8 or 9, you know, applicants there, and I made a comment at the beginning about how I was going to step back one more step and give some introduction so that the undergraduates visiting could start at the same place. All right, so you're really talking to everyone. And I don't think those 9 applicants got a vote. In fact, I'm certain that they didn't get a vote. But just that simple thing of acknowledging everyone in the audience went a long, long way. I actually ended up being at that university for about 12 years before I came here. So everyone matters. You're talking to outsiders, and the composition of this audience will be different than you're used to here at NIH or back at your university when you were in graduate school. And it grossly differs from a scientific meeting. So if you made slides for a Gordon conference on protease inhibitors, not a single slide will be perfect as is for this type of general audience. All right? Anything that you showed at your branch presentation is probably too specific for this kind of audience. So step back and think about it as broadly as you can. Rule number 2 is know the rules. And by that I mean know exactly what the host is looking for. For those of you applying for research-intensive jobs, that's an easy one. They want a science seminar. Okay, that one is really, I think, easy to get. But for those of you applying at a Research 2 institution, an institution that predominantly gives master's degrees, an institution where a large amount of undergraduate teaching is considered important for the job, it may be that what they're asking for is a teaching talk, not a research talk. In all likelihood, they will want both, but you need to understand the difference between the two. So a teaching talk is actually standing in front of a group of people and teaching as you would in a classroom. It can be simulated. Pretend you're teaching genetics seminar, okay, to a group of seniors. So it could be a completely made-up, simulated experience. Or it could be you're the guest lecturer in the cell biology class today. All right, so that is a teaching talk. And if somebody says, we'd like you to come and give a teaching talk, they don't generally mean a talk about your own research. It is rare to get asked to give just a teaching talk, but we do get feedback from people on the job market. And at schools where research is not their main focus, sometimes they choose only to do a teaching talk at the outset. All right. So a science talk is on your science. A teaching talk is to teach students in the audience, and a chalk talk is to engage a small set of faculty or a small set of leaders in industry in an informal way about your research. No slides, no plan talking, a give and take. Generally around a table, often with coffee and donuts. Go try eating while you're standing up in front of the room trying to impress 15 people. And it's a much less formal type of talk. Chalk talks sometimes come on the second interview. Sometimes universities do not use chalk talks. And sometimes on day one, you give a formal science talk, and on day two, you give an informal chalk talk. All right? Never show up for a chalk talk with slides. When they say chalk talk, they mean here you are with a piece of chalk, although now chalk is typically some markers and a whiteboard. It is very easy here at the NIH. Lots of things blew my mind in making this transition from the university to the NIH, but one thing that blew my mind the most is how I walk into the room and somebody takes my memory stick and poof, I give a talk. Okay? They have computers set up, they have expertise, they hand you everything that you need. There's almost always a laser pointer. That is not the case at many universities, so don't assume anything about the computer and the AV equipment. Okay? Ask in advance and definitely take some backups. So bring your stuff on a memory stick, write it onto a DVD that you throw into your knapsack, and verify if they need you to bring a computer. Also, when it comes to a teaching talk, there are classrooms that are hardwired with the highest technology called a smart room or smart classroom. And there are classrooms where the teacher writes on an old-fashioned board with a piece of white chalk. And you wouldn't want to show up expecting a smart room to find out that you need to draw your models on the blackboard. So don't assume anything when it comes to technology. I think probably 5 years from now I'll be able to take that advice off because we'll all go to the web and download our presentations and it'll be very easy. But many universities are far behind technology when it comes to equipping their classrooms and seminar rooms. And finally, know how long you have to speak. I think there's a knee-jerk assumption that there's an hour. Okay, that's every seminar we've ever gone to in an academic setting is an hour. But at smaller universities, sometimes they want students there, so they use a class time. And that can be 50 minutes, meaning you really only have about 40 by the time the introductions are done. In addition, industry does not always ask for an hour talk. I had a student who interviewed at three different industry settings, and he gave three different talks. A 20-minute talk, which was more like a chalk talk. They wanted him to talk about how his research could be applied. He gave a 40-minute talk that was sort of an abbreviated thesis defense talk, and then he gave a talk that went for 75 minutes. And in each case, he was told in advance, but it came as a great surprise to him. I don't think he read that carefully. He said, oh, yes, science talk, and then to realize that he had to fill 75 minutes versus 40 minutes. So make sure that you know how long you have to speak, and make sure that you speak that long. So I talked a little bit about the timings already, okay? The most important thing is to deduct 10 minutes from that time. Answering the questions is a chance for you to really sell yourself. It's a chance for you to connect with people in the audience. It's a chance for you to show how smart, careful, thoughtful, exciting, creative you are. If you rush through and go over and lose time for the questions, no one is going to stay to listen except the few people that have to. Okay, so typically the search committee has to stay, and they'll grudgingly stay as you go over. But most people will get up and leave. So whatever you do, leave time for questions. And consider and think through in advance what you're going to do if you get a late start. Okay, what can you go faster? What are you going to do no matter what? And how are you going to finish in time? You will get a huge amount of positive credit if you know, the computer doesn't work when you get started and you just go ahead and start without your slides, okay? But think through how you're going to do that, okay? Sometimes people have their data in sort of small, discrete packages, right? Which one could you skip if you had to? Don't plan to use that, okay? So don't add lots of slides not paying any attention to the timing. Pay careful attention to the timing. Then think, okay, so if something really goes wrong, how am I, you know, the bulb burns out, which has happened to three people who interviewed for jobs that I've interacted with while I was at UNC. In the middle of their talk, the bulb just went poof, which is also something that never happens at the NIH, I've noticed. It's very interesting. Exactly how are you going to deal with time issues? So those are the most, I think, important rules to think about. This one here is absolutely, if you learn nothing else from today, if you took this home and thought hard about it, you'd be in good shape. This is so different than a science talk. Because when you go and give a science seminar, you're selling one thing, your science, right? You're telling them your science. In this case, these people are trying to decide if they want to live with you. Okay, they're trying to decide if you are going to be a fun colleague, if you are going to honor your teaching commitments, if you are going to be the whiner at faculty meeting who irritates the hell out of them every time, if you're going to be a colleague who says, sure, I can do that, a colleague who takes teaching and mentoring seriously, a colleague who, you know, gets the industry perspective, a colleague who cares about that company. Okay, someone they want to talk sports with or movies with or kids with or whatever. They are really trying to evaluate you. And I would actually venture a guess that if you asked 100 chairs of departments or divisions, whether it be industry or academia or government, that 80% would say the person trumps science. That's not to say they're going to hire someone who doesn't do good science. But people who do good science are actually a dime a dozen. People who do good science and are good employees and good colleagues and good citizens of science are not a dime a dozen. And you have a chance to try and sell yourself in addition to trying to sell your science. All right, so that very nervous standing there hovering, really meek, can someone give me the slides? That sends the message, you know, what message? I don't feel confident. I don't want to be here. Someone said you were so unenthusiastic, right? That second introduction sent the message, you know, if you hire me, look what you get. Enthusiasm, energy, excitement. All right, you can't be who you're not, but hopefully you're going to find the right place to work and the right type of career, and you're going to be able to sell yourself in a really enthusiastic way. The third thing that the audience is evaluating is your fit, okay, in the department or the division. And this is equally true in industry, academia, and government. So you could do a great job on the seminar, okay? You could throw out there amazing pieces of data, you know, that people just say, wow. But in the back of their mind, they're trying to imagine working with you. What does she bring that's different from everyone else in the audience? What is he going to do to help me? Okay, and I want you to keep in mind that part of help me. So some people, when they think me, they think about their own research group, and some people think about the department, and some people are thinking about the university. So each person in the room has a different opinion of what a good fit would be, but everyone is evaluating that. So new technologies, okay? Someone could be sitting there saying, gosh, I've been wanting to do microarrays for a long time, and this person does, you know, microarrays and prints their own. This is just terrific. But then you have to convey to that person how collaborative you are, right? How open you are to questions, to sharing technology. Someone else might say, well, I'm the director of this unit, and I'm really looking for a team player. You need to show in your talk how good of a team player you are. Somebody else might be thinking, well, I'm looking for someone who can help me with my summer research program. So every time you talk about a young student that worked with you in the lab, that person is saying, oh, he'll probably take one of my students. All right? Everyone is looking at what you bring to them. And although that is science predominantly, especially at a Research One university or in industry, it is actually much more beyond the actual experiments. Does that make sense to people? Okay. I think if you were going to order these, you might actually debate whether science or fit came second or third. So these are not in order. Without a doubt, you is number one. But beyond that, it depends on the job and the people. It may be that you read this fourth one of teaching ability and think, well, that's just if I'm looking at a job that involves a lot of teaching. But if I'm going to the NIH or a university where teaching is hardly important, or industry where there are no students walking around, how important could this be? Okay, teaching ability doesn't really matter in that case. You're actually wrong. Because those of you in industry will teach in the lab. You will teach business people about your research. You will teach synthetic chemists about diabetes. Okay, you will teach in just a different way. In addition, a surprising number of industries bring in summer students and interns as a way to both give back to their community, but also, I think, to develop homegrown talent with the hopes that someone is going to get a great, warm, fuzzy feeling about Merck and end up back there. Okay. So in industry, they're looking at teaching. Obviously not as much as at Oberlin, where you're going to teach three courses on a regular basis. In many Research One universities, where your predominant responsibility is research, we still don't want 1,000 complaints from the students about how bad a teacher you are. And so we really are watching that. Less so, but we're still watching that. And obviously, when you think about a teaching university or in a job where you will be teaching all the time, that would be one of the most important criteria. One thing that foreign fellows often come to talk to me about is the notion that there's an assumption made by undergraduates sometimes that someone with an accent is not a very good teacher. And actually, there's a fairly large literature on that, and without a doubt, depending on the college and the environment, there are some biases. That said, if you are invited for an interview, it is because that school and search committee thinks you would be a terrific addition. So I would put that to rest. I would do the best job as you possibly can to communicate clearly, and I would not worry about it at all. And it often comes up in practice things. What should I do? You know, well, you're who you are, and that's exactly who you should be. Finally, and this depends a lot on what you're being hired for, people are looking at your leadership and management style. At a Research One university, we want you to fill your lab with trainees, and we don't want them to be making complaints every day. We don't want to be negotiating lab changes on a regular basis. Same thing in government, okay? You're going to be mentoring people in the lab, and we'd like to know that you have an understanding of how to do that. In industry, although you might be being hired, right, immediately to be at the bench, what people are doing is saying, 10 years from now, can I make that person in charge? Or even better, 2 years from now, is he going to show such natural talent as a group leader that I'm going to solve my problem when we reorganize and spin off a new division? So even though the job immediately might seem at the bench, it is really all about your ability to grow and fit in the company. In small startup companies, this is absolutely critical from the start. When there are 8 or 10 scientists and a great hope that, you know, with additional funding, the company is going to grow quickly from 8 to 50, okay, natural-born leaders, or people who have learned to lead, which is really more likely. There aren't very many natural-born leaders walking around. There are people with natural tendencies towards leadership, but we all really need to learn how to lead. People who can manage, they're the ones who are going to get hired. So even if the science wasn't the optimal fit, many companies will go still with the with someone who can show their leadership and management style. Okay? So in every case, regardless of academia, industry, government, you in some way want to convey your ability to direct a team. And that's hard in a science seminar. What context do you have there really to demonstrate that? Okay, and so we'll talk a little bit about that and the words that you can use and the way that you can answer questions that will help you to show this. People make judgments about you fairly quickly in the audience during a job talk, and you should realize that. So simply using the name of someone who did the work, John, a summer student in our group last year, right, that says, gives credit, supervised, right, actually got something out of this summer student, right? So very small little things can convey those issues on the list. All right, so that's sort of the general thinking about it before you actually get started. Anybody have any general questions about what you're trying to do at a job talk? I know it's Monday morning. I know it's easy to sit back, but please ask questions. I would hate to leave and then get 20 really great questions by email. That tends to happen all the time, and really everybody would like to see, A, hear the question, and B, hear the answer. All right, so rule number four, and this is where you have to start planning your seminar. Rule number four is tell a story. This is really key. And a story is not a talk written out and read. I mean, a story is not a paper written out and read. Sorry about that. I couldn't have done that any worse. Let me say that again, okay? You're not trying to speak one of your papers, all right? You are trying to tell a story. Often to tell a story, you have to rewrite experimental history, okay? And by that I mean you don't have to say your results in the order that the experiments were done, all right? You have to tell the story the best possible way. All right, an example of that is a student of mine who is now actually in a small biotech company, but he did that by way of a much larger pharmaceutical company. He came to my lab and said, I want to do proteomics. And he spent about 2 years optimizing mass spec approaches. Okay, pretty dry, pretty technical, lots of little steps forward, lots of steps back. We tried these 20 detergents, etc. Pretty ho-hum. Not a great beginning to a story. Eventually, he actually found several interacting proteins that were pretty exciting, and he went off to do the biology. Okay, so his thesis is written from technology development to finding binding partners to studying one of them. That's fine. Okay, but his job talk was in a completely different order. We found this really interesting regulator of ion channels. This was for a job in a company that was interested in drugs to impact ion channels. All he really talked about were ion channels, ion channel regulators, ion channel interactors, ion channels, ion channels, ion channels. And he came back at the end and said, but really, I showed you something that we were really proud and excited about, and it came after about 2 years of pain and agony optimizing things. And so I'm going to give you the take-home messages on things to think about. All right? He completely rewrote history. He didn't start and say, we did this, and then we did this, and we showed that, so we did this. And almost always when I get to see a job talk for the first time, people tell one story from a paper, and then the next story from their next paper, and the next story of the paper they're working on. And it would be much better to take all those figures and throw them up in the air and decide how they fit together best. All right, rewrite history however you want to tell the story. No one wants to hear all your data. That's a hard thing to actually hear because we all, well, I wish I was sitting at, well, I actually take that back. I was going to say we all sit at the lab bench, you know, and we want to share everything that we do, but I realized that it's been a while since I've sat at the lab bench and done anything. Every experiment is important, but not every experiment has to be shared. And very early on, you have to figure out what to show and what not to show. Best foot forward, key experiments, really, really significant findings, technology advances that you plan to use again and again, okay, or technology advances that you really drove. That's what gets showed, okay? Not every piece of data. You can bring 20 slides in the back. So when I tell people, cut out those 6 slides, it's published already, just summarize it, they get really nervous and they say, but someone could ask me. All right, so if you're nervous that way, throw those slides in the back, okay? And if somebody says, but didn't you show whatever, or did you do this, you can say, yes, I did, and flip ahead, all right? And definitely highlight key points with repetition, okay? So as you are telling your story, come back to the main points and repeat them again and again. So when people leave, they think about the job candidate who showed that stem cells are pluripotent and need X, Y, and Z, okay? Not, oh, yeah, she works on something in niches in bone marrow, okay? So whatever it is that you want them to remember, highlight again and again and again. And no successful storyteller stands behind a podium and is monotone. Storytellers use body language, they use intonation, they use gestures to embellish their story, okay? I sat in a job interview where I served on the search committee for the biology department, and the person being hired was gonna do a lot of teaching, where the person reached behind the podium at one point in their seminar, they were explaining strand breaks in DNA, and they had a small model. And everyone spent a lot of time talking about that, okay? So, they had a really complex slide, and we all were like, ooh, and then the next thing we knew, we could see it. And I'm not saying you should all travel with props, and certainly if you did that at a Research One university, it could potentially go off very poorly. I'm not sure I would advise that, okay? But some way, gestures and hand movements add a whole lot. On the other hand, they can really distract, okay? When I started at UNC, after about 2 years, I went to one of these holiday things and was horrified to see the students in a nice way, it was a holiday party, of course, doing these skits, and every distracting body movement I had was right there for me to see. And I did this one because this is one that I really struggle with. So if I'm nervous, this is what I do. Okay, and also I grew up in a family that talked with their hands, right? So my hands are everywhere and I'm moving all over the place. So you can reach a point where you are distracting by your intonation and your gestures and your body language. But most of you don't use enough of that, okay? That is something that communication coaches tell you is something that most of us err on the side of too much. There are some gestures, jiggling change in your pocket, that are very dangerous and risky, and they can often get picked up by the mic. You know, so it's not a bad idea to ask your friends if you have some irritating habits like that, but most of us need to get away from the podium a little bit and to engage the audience, use something beyond our words, all right? It can go a long way to turning it from a talk into a story. So there are two approaches that people use. The mystery thriller approach, how many people like to read mysteries? So if you read the last few pages, you wouldn't need to read the rest, right? I read lots of mysteries and never would I turn to the end. So a mystery thriller starts and introduces the players and then something happens, right? And then something else happens, and something else happens, and you get to the last chapter, and you know what the outcome was. All right? So that's the mystery thriller approach to giving a job talk. So the benefit of that is it can build a lot of excitement. Right? If you have a really great story, what gene is it that's involved in this complex disease, and what are the mutations? You could really sort of get people sitting on the end of their chairs to hear the outcome, okay? But the risk is the minute I get distracted and start thinking about the fact that I promised I would take out the recycling in the morning and I forgot, okay? Or, oh, I have to leave tonight for New York. I better change my mail message. I better get my ticket. The minute I get distracted, okay, and then I try to come back, I've lost key steps in between, and it's very, very hard to come back. Okay. So although this can work, and I have seen people use it, it is a very risky approach, and it can be very, very hard to pull off unless you've really practiced. The other approach, some people call it the onion approach. I like to call it the sneak preview approach. And that is that you tell people some of your general findings early on. Okay. So what I'm going to share with you today is the identification of two protein interactions that regulate CFTR activity at the plasma membrane. One is a phosphatase, and one is a protein that regulates internalization and stability. So if somebody really wanders, they have a general idea. Okay, if you do that, you want to be careful not to give too much detail that people can't understand. So that's one of the big difficulties in this approach, is people tend to tell everything, in which case the audience says, okay, I got it. Now let me pull out my shopping list. All right. So you want to think it through and decide what works. Some people argue that a hybrid of the two works. I actually think it matters a little bit on your data and a little bit on your personality, which one works the best. But it's really worth thinking through and deciding how to do it up front. Okay, so the beginning is the hook that gets people to listen to you. So there's a study done where undergraduate students watched a 90-second video of faculty members without any sound. So a silent video. Okay. And those students predicted whether the faculty member was going to get a good review or a bad review when they taught a class. Okay, so a 90-second silent video, and then they voted, and then 6 months later, after those faculty members taught a class and got evaluated, they compared the 90-second evaluation to the 6-month class evaluation. And it turns out, with a high statistical probability, the first 90 seconds of an interaction in a room like this is predictive of the evaluation. If you connect with people in the first 90 seconds to 2 minutes, and you grab their attention, and you convey, I am going to be a great colleague, you are going to love talking science with me, I'm careful, here I go, you're going to most likely do better than if in the first 2 minutes you tell a dumb joke, you read your title slide, and you mess around with your notes and your water. 2 minutes is about what you have, okay? And I think that's the case in all seminars. You know, people come lots of people in this audience, well, someone's sleeping, someone's reading a paper, probably 10 people are making notes unrelated to this, right? In every seminar, people are going to decide pretty early on whether to try to engage and follow or just to use it as an hour to relax. But here, not only are they going to decide that, but they're going to even decide further about how excited they are about your candidacy. So you have 2 minutes about, okay? Your introduction should paint the big picture. Think about it as a triangle. At the bottom, you're the broadest, the really big picture. And as you go from one slide to another, you get narrower and narrower until you get to the question of, now, here's what I did. Okay, and you really need to answer two questions. Why do we care? Okay, and that reflects what we know and don't know about a field. Okay, what do we know already? And what am I going to tell you about that's unique and special? Okay, no amount of, if your science is not good, it makes no difference how exciting this introduction is. All right. You have to have good science. I'm assuming that part already. If you have good science and you set this introduction up well, you have hooked them and reeled them in and you're on your way. Generally, these introductions are longer than in a regular science seminar. If you are at a teaching institution, it should really be considerably longer. Okay? If you're at a Research One job interview, that is a very broad department, it's going to need to be longer. If you are in industry and you are talking to people who have very little understanding of your field, you're really going to need to give background. So in this case, your introduction could be much longer than it normally would be. And that's why your slides from your branch talk don't work. Okay, you're going to need to make more introductory slides. Almost always, a figure is better than words. I guess someone could come up with an example for me that would argue that words are better than a figure, but I actually would suspect that's a very rare occurrence. People don't like to read that much. People certainly do not want to read full sentences. Really, people are sitting in the audience to be entertained. I sometimes, when I was on the job market, I had some beers with some other colleagues of mine that were on the job market, and I said I envisioned that job talks were a little bit like back in Roman times where everybody would gather to watch the people jousting and fighting, sort of that blood sport. People come, and they sort of hope you do a good job, but they really enjoy watching the event of the whole thing. It can be $1 million to bring in a new colleague, okay? By the time you move someone, by the time you give them incentives to come, by the time you've flown them back and forth with their partners 5 times to find a place to live, we're talking about a huge investment of time. And so these are big events, okay? And certainly the committee wishes that wishes you well, but at the same time, the committee is really, you know, trying to see what's this person going to do. Are they going to screw up? Are they going to be great? And so anything that you can do to entertain, but entertain within the context of great science is a good thing. Okay, and that's why I say within the context of good science. So I've seen job applicants mistake that wanting to sort of connect personally and telling too many anecdotes and trying to connect in sort of too frivolous of a way. So it's hard because you want to connect, but you want to connect about your science. So your introduction will be longer, and by the end, people are going to know why we care. Something that I have seen done extremely well, I've seen at a distance, two of my neighbors work for Glaxo. Well, two of my old neighbors work for Glaxo. And so at one point, I did a program there at Glaxo, and in return, they sent some people to UNC to do a program for us. Something that they pointed out about industry introductions that I just want to throw out there is very often you're really interviewing to do something completely different. You're a genomics expert, but you don't know anything about the particular area of interest in the company. All right? So you can give your general introduction to your area and then spend 1 or 2 slides, 1 or 2 minutes, showing how this kind of work is easily related to the company and their unit and their mission. Okay? So that example I gave you before of the a student of mine who went out to industry, they had no interest in lung diseases. He interviewed at a company that was interested in ion channels involved in taste. So he gave his general introduction to cystic fibrosis and protein interactions, and then he pointed out how the general principles could be applied to anything, and he came up next was a slide with 10 taste receptors and several interacting proteins that were floating out there in the literature. So you can not only use your introduction as a hook to your science, but you can use your introduction to sort of generalize the conversation. And that is really important in industry. It can be important in teaching at a teaching institution. I think it is least important at a research one type of job talk, but something to think about. All right, anybody have any questions about the beginning? All right, so if the beginning is the hook, the middle is the meat. Two questions. You want to answer two questions. What is exciting about my work, and what is unique about my model system and my approach? Okay. Now you're selling your science. Okay. What is it that I do that's special, that you would not want being done down the road instead of here? Okay. This is your chance to get this unbelievable science done by an unbelievable person, okay? And that's what you're trying to show. What is unique about my model system and my approach? In this case, always avoid the royal we. Does everybody know what I mean by the royal we? No, okay. So the royal we is when you use the word we no matter what. And sometimes, so when I use the word we, it never means me. I never did the experiment. So when I say we did, you know, that just means, well, I was in the room talked about it once. Okay. But we could mean a collaborator of mine across the country or the world, right? It could mean a student in my lab. It could mean a student in the neighboring lab. In this case, everyone wants to know who did the work. This is particularly concerning in Research One universities, if you come from a big lab, okay, people want to know, did you do it or did you drop the sample off and pick up the data? Okay, so you want to avoid the royal we. In industry, this is an unbelievable chance in an industry interview for you to show that you are a boss. All right, so if you did it, say I. If someone in your lab did it, and you did it as a member of a team, say we. And if someone who worked with you or under you, a student or postbac that you mentored, use their name. Something that is very important is industry is often evaluating your ability to be a part of a team. So if all you do is use I, they're going to be worried. One of the speakers who came for the career symposium in April, emailed me afterward and said, your fellows use I exclusively or we exclusively. And when I was having lunch, I could never really tell what they did and what they collaborated on. So think that through carefully, because actually people are paying attention to those pronouns. Okay. I actually think that many Research One universities are looking to see which technologies you can do, and they're also looking to see whether you've run a research group or not, whether you've supervised people. So I would not use the royal we exclusively. I would not use I exclusively. If you go through a talk and everything is I did this all myself, I think it's worth considering whether you're going to be able to sustain that long-term in your career, because eventually you're going to have 20 other things to do during the day and start developing some collaborations and some ability to work as a we. This is also a chance for you to show how critical you are and how thoughtful you are. Do not put a ribbon around bad data, okay? Do not show any data that's sort of mediocre that you wish was better unless you present it in that light. I want to show you these data because they are a really critical next step. but I'm working hard to optimize the culture conditions here. Okay? This is a computer program that I've developed in collaboration with several other people in my lab, and right now it's working at 80% reliability. We realize we really need to improve that. But some key points to learn from it are, okay, so you show that you're critical and thoughtful. Very often we see really bad data. And I see this in grants, so this is a great take-home message for everything. Okay, I got my siRNA to work, and I just want to show you that. Okay, but it only worked halfway, and there weren't great controls, and actually it's an okay lab meeting piece of data, but not a great data for a job talk. Yet people soldier through and put the best possible spin on it. Okay, in this case, you want to put the most thoughtful spin on it. If you have to show it, you have to show it. All right, sometimes you need it for your story, all right, but show how critical you are about it. This is really a chance to show that you're thoughtful in another way. Nobody wants someone who doesn't put their work in context. So here also what I mean is this is your chance to point out what other people have done that's important. This is a chance for you to relate your work to other people's work, okay? And that sometimes doesn't happen so much in the body of the talk, but often you made a choice about experiments based on what's in the field. And again, you're telling a story. You're not reading the paper. So it isn't figure one, and then I did, and then I did, and then I did. It's why I did it. It's what we expected to see. So it's easy in that regard to put your work in context. Does that make sense? So I've seen people talk over the audience's head, and people get it disengaged pretty quickly. We interviewed a job candidate. We wanted a systems neuroscientist. So we wanted someone who did both some cognitive neuroscience and some molecular neuroscience, which is hard. It's hard to find those people. Over time, there's more and more being trained. But back when this job search happened, it was pretty difficult to find. And there are six layers of the brain, zones 1 through 6, that do different things during development. I don't actually know that much about it. There's some neuroscientist in here laughing at that description. This person color-coded them and the entire time talked about the red zone and the blue zone and the green zone. So that's sort of simplifying and connecting, trying to connect too much, okay? In fact, we all felt sort of insulted, okay? But I've seen just the opposite, where people are going into such depth in this section and such intense discussion, you know, using all kinds of complex algorithms that people in the audience get really turned off. So you are trying to show what's unique and special, how critical you are, how much this fits into the field, but at a level that relates to the outsiders, but still gives the impression you think they're smart. Okay, in fact, that was a comment made by many faculty on that search committee was, well, did she think I was stupid that I couldn't remember the name of these zones, right? And I can't believe that something like that undid a candidacy, but it was pretty damning, all right? So you need to show your talk to a lot of people, and if they're a little queasy about, you know, how you've pitched it, you need to think it through really carefully, all right? Anybody have any questions about the middle and what you're trying to do? So the end is looking forward, okay? If the beginning is looking both backward and forward, and the middle is sort of immediate, here's what I'm doing right now. The end is really forward-looking. And this is an extremely different process in academic versus industry. Okay? In academia, you are often getting hired to continue that work. So they want to know what you are going to do next. Okay? In industry, very often, you are going to completely stop that work and do something else. So your job is to tie your skills and what you've learned to what you're going to do. So it's a very different looking forward, okay? when you think about academia, think about a research-type position versus a teaching position. Okay, so if you are getting hired predominantly because you will teach and mentor undergraduates, and the idea is that you will involve them in your research, this looking to the future is how you're going to do that. Not only this is the science I'm going to do, but this is why I think it would be so terrific for undergraduates. This project, you know, I plan to do X and Y and Z, and I think this will be great for students in the immunology course because they will get a chance to learn about cytokines in this cell culture model system. But in addition, it's amenable to mentoring in the lab because of X and Y. Does that make sense? It's some way to bring it back to the fit and what you bring that's special. In a research one job where you're being hired predominantly to do research, I think that's not as important. And what's most important is to tell them what you're going to do next. Almost always people flip to a pretty word-heavy slide that lists aim one, aim two, aim three. And you can do that. And I actually have seen it work. I actually don't care what people are going to do next. I took my job and then didn't do a single thing I told them I was going to do. And so I come from the extreme perspective of if I think someone is really smart, if I think someone is really creative, if I think they know how to get good advice, they'll figure out what to do. Also, I came from a lab where there was some tension when people left. So, you know, who's going to take what? Although we always worked it out, everybody worked it out, there always was tension at the beginning. So it was hard to walk in and say, I'm going to do this, this, and this, because it was still being negotiated and debated and talked about. And I was, you know, so I come from the perspective of not caring that much about the next experiment. All right, so I would say I'm on an extreme, and the minute they put up aim one, aim two, aim three, I stop listening. I like to hear a couple of the technologies they throw out. But this whole listing of aims doesn't do it for me. Some people really like, you know, my first grant is going to be this, and this is what I'm going to do. I actually think that's hard to pull off, and a hybrid approach would be to put out a couple questions that you want to address. So knowing now what we know about System X, my goal will be to address the following questions. And then the next slide is, you know, what are the signaling pathways involved in whatever? Here's how I might get at it. And I find that works a little bit better and is more interesting than a list of specific aims. That said, someone is going to ask you if you actually have specific aims. And so if you're going to take the less formal approach here, bring your specific aims in your bag. I think it's very, very hard to talk about where you're going within the context of a lot of words. So I would go with the questions and model systems. It is not necessary to spend a lot of time on this. I've seen people spend 15 minutes on this, and I would say you're talking more like 5 minutes. For one thing, you are going to spend 2 days talking about this with everyone, all right? And it's much easier to do one-on-one. The second thing is either the next day you're going to do a chalk talk, or if you get invited back, you're going to do a chalk talk. So I wouldn't put as much emphasis on this as some people do. And this is a little one, and it seems not to matter, but I have seen so many people give a great talk where they absolutely have hit a home run. And then you never know that they're done. They just stop, and someone wants to clap, but you're not sure if you should clap because you don't know if they're done. So it is not a bad idea when you are finished to say thank you, and I really look forward to the discussion now. Okay? Make it easy for the audience to start clapping for you. Okay? So I really encourage you to add that one simple little thing in. All right. I talked a little bit before about making sure to stick within your time, without a doubt. So I read lots of articles in preparation for this, right? And everybody, every article agrees that going over time is absolutely the kiss of death, okay? And although most of us will just talk fast so that we don't go over time, we'll look at the clock and we'll say, oh, I only have 45 minutes, I better speed up. That's a bad strategy, okay? The better strategy is to cut slides before you got on the plane, all right? The other common way of dealing with going over time is getting to the end and saying, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to skip all of these. If you skip two or three slides and it goes pretty quickly, I don't think that is the kiss of death. But very often people overanimate their talk, and so you have to hit like 30 times to skip three slides. So it's not your best strategy. Your best strategy is to plan in advance. I recommend that people use guideposts. So for example, I knew, okay, in getting ready for this, that I needed to be at this point at 10:20. It is now 10:13. So I'm okay. All right. When I give a science seminar, I know that I tend to overdo it in the introduction. It's my favorite part, actually. The details of the science aren't as exciting to me as sort of painting the big picture. So I tend to overdo my introductions, and I now know that I get invited a lot of times to give seminars because people want to hear the details. Okay, so I have built in a guidepost that I have to get to my last introductory slide 10 minutes into my seminar. And by building that in and noticing, and I give a half a dozen to a dozen seminars a year now, I've actually started to be able to do that. So you build in a couple guideposts when you're practicing, and you make sure that you can see your watch without insulting people, okay? So if you're lucky, you're going to be in a room like this where it's really easy to see the room. But if not, have a really easy watch, not one where you have to push a button and to light it up. Buy yourself a really good watch for your interview so you know where you are. And then you can speed up a little bit if you need to, or cut out a story if you need to. Rule of thumb, 30 to 35 slides, okay? How many times I sit with someone to practice a job talk and there's 50 slides and they say, but that's fine, one slide, 1 minute per slide. Almost no one talks a minute per slide. Okay. If you are interviewing for a teaching at a teaching institution, that's the kiss of death to go that quickly. Okay. If you are talking to an industrial audience, right, full of HR people and MBAs and marketing people and synthetic chemists, you can't possibly connect with them and explain the background in a minute per slide. All right. Only the most specialized audience can withstand a minute per slide. And even then, I would argue most of us don't want that much data. Okay, we really would prefer a slower pace. So I actually think this is overdoing it. I had 20 to 25. And that, I think, there's a risk of finishing too early that is equally as serious as the risk of not having enough. And so I upped it a little bit in thinking about it. And finally, there is no way to finish on time except to practice, okay? And I don't mean practice, you're sitting at home and you got the PowerPoint up and you're sort of, and then I'll say this, and yeah, yeah. That's not practicing, okay? That's not really a waste of your time, but that's what you should do at the end after you've really practiced. Most people will say two practices is the minimum. Four practices is too many. You do not want this to seem canned and low energy. So if you practice too much and you sort of memorize it and you're just phoning it in, it doesn't work. But in general, it takes two to three practices to get the timing right. Eventually, you'll reach a point in your career where you don't need to practice at all. Okay? But at this point, for most of you, two to three practices will go a long, long way, and it will help you finish on time. Also, we talked a lot about using gestures and body language, and only when you stand up in front of an audience and get feedback can you work that out. All right. I used to teach a first-year seminar class where each student had to give talks, and it was so interesting. One student would come up. So we'd do like 10 students at a time. We'd close the door, and there'd be bagels. One student is all over the place with their gestures, and then the next one would be rigid, right? And we'd be like, we just want to sort of make a chimera here, and it will be perfect. You cannot figure any of that out without practice. So both the timing of your talk and how you're going to convey yourself are going to matter a lot and be really, really helped by practice. A general rule of thumb about answering questions is it's damn hard to get good at this. I think it's just one of the most difficult things that you will do. So the first thing is to make sure you understand what's being asked. And that can be very difficult. And if you don't, ask for clarification as respectfully as you can. The second thing is to repeat the question, because you're going to get thrown off track when the curmudgeon in the back of the room who didn't hear is going to say, "Can you repeat the question?" So just repeat it. Unless you are in a very small room and it is very clear that everyone heard it, repeat it. A, it confirms you know what you're talking about before you give an answer, and B, it's courteous to everyone. Do not give very, very long digressions for answers. Answer the question. Try to avoid long digressions, but be respectful and say, "I can talk about that more after the seminar." I find most people err on the side of not answering enough, okay? And very few people have a problem of going on too long, but people do digress and get off topic during questions. So think about that. When somebody asks an aggressive question or challenges your work, do not take the bait. Stay respectful, stay calm, answer the question. And I think I've seen in job talks too many times where someone asks an aggressive question. I think some people use it as a real way of evaluating people. I think their goal is to go in and ask a hard, challenging question. So do not take the bait. This is the one time where I think using your water to give yourself a minute is a good idea. All right, so if you get a question, A, you have no damn idea how you're going to answer that. They throw out some obscure paper that you've never read or a paper that you think is crap, right? And so you don't really want to debate the validity of your findings against this, you know, and you need a minute, that's the best time to open your water. Make it clear that you're thinking, but give yourself a minute to think. The biggest mistake that I see is the person that prefaces their answer to every question with, "What a great question." I actually do that myself a little bit too much. And I think in this type of seminar, it's okay. But when I go give a science seminar, you know, not every question is great. Some of them are bad ideas, right? Some of them are things you are not going to do within the next 5 years because on your list of priorities, it is way at the bottom. And you come off looking sort of trivial if everything is great. Oh, what a great question. What a great idea. Yeah, we're doing that next. I have a fellow in my lab who answers every question by saying, "Yes, we're looking at that." And I finally sat down with him and I said, "We are not. Like, we are looking at maybe two out of these things." Okay? The thing is, if you say, "Oh, yeah, we're looking at that," then you're going to sit down with that person the next day and they're going to ask you about it. And really, you're not. So the best thing to do is to answer honestly. Occasionally you will really get a great question. Occasionally you'll get a question that you hadn't thought about before and you really appreciate it. But be genuine in all of that. If you have to say, "I don't know," this is one case where you need to follow up. All right. So I go out on seminars now and I wish I was up on the literature more than I am. And I'm not. And so I find myself saying, "I don't know." And I almost never follow up with the person. If they want to know the answer, they should go to PubMed and look. Okay? But at the job talk time, if you say, "I don't know," and it seems to matter, it's a faculty member, it's someone who might have some influence with the search committee, you want to follow up with them. And you can say that. You can say, you know, I'm caught by surprise here. I hadn't really considered that model system and that approach, but I'll grab you later and maybe we can talk about it a little. You should probably follow up if you say, I don't know. This is one case where every time you give a job interview talk, you should add, you should come back when you have a quiet minute and jot down any questions that caught you by surprise, because you can make sure to know the answer for the next one. Okay, so the next rule, my computer seems to not be very happy today, is to have crisp, clean data slides. And I'm not going to talk a lot about this as part of our communication series. I hope that we will offer regular sort of overview seminars about good slides and good talks. I will also preface my comments by telling you you're getting one person's opinion, and in this case, you are getting an opinion from somebody at an extreme. I think PowerPoint is the worst thing that happened to graduate students and postdoctoral fellows. 1,000 million-plus palette colors is the kiss of death. All that animation, all that sound, all those backgrounds, all the ability to pick your pastels and your fades is the worst thing that happened. So I never give a seminar that isn't on a white background with black words. I have occasionally been asked by the provost or the dean for some dog and pony show talk to move my slides onto a black background with yellow because that's what everyone's going to use. I often at my first slide would have a Carolina logo or now my NHLBI logo. But I believe none of that is useful. And probably something for some of you is. So you're going to get probably the most extreme view of that. All right. I think a clean, readable, cohesive color scheme and layout is critical, and it should be as simple as possible. Back in Clinton Dole? Did he run against Bob Dole first time? You know, they said, you know, it's all about the economy, right? It's all about the economy, nothing else but the economy. In this case, it's all about the data on the slides, okay? The simpler, the better. If you show lots of micrographs and that would work better on a black background, go with black. But pick one cohesive scheme and stick with it. I never understood why everyone said sans serif fonts. So that's Arial, Helvetica, ones that don't have the curly Q's on the end. But it turns out that at a distance, people cannot read serif fonts like Times and Times New Roman. So use a simple font. This is Arial. It's the only one I use. Okay. When I make slides, I use Arial. If I am going to lecture undergraduates and I want to be fun and whimsical, I use the Blackboard font. Okay. But if I want to send the message, I'm a serious scientist, here's what I do, and women really need to send that message in particular, do not use some whimsical little font and whimsical color scheme. Okay. Every time you can take out words on a slide, you should. I have now given the same orientation to postbacks 7 times, and my slides are still too wordy. Okay. So somebody said 30 words per slide, and these kinds of seminars are very hard because there's no picture I could show you. I did look a little bit. I'm like, what a boring presentation. Let me find some pictures. And then I thought, actually, they're here to hear the words. So this is not a great example. But on a data slide, 30 words is too many. Okay? You want to cut and cut and cut. So make your slides early and cut. Then cut them again. Then cut them again. Okay? Anything that you can do for your slides to be as clean and readable as possible, you should do. I don't think it matters in this case, industry, academia, teaching versus intensive research. In any case, whatever, however clean and clear and crisp and focused and perfect your slides are, you're in good shape. I don't think it differs in any way. It is absolutely true that a white background in a massively huge room, like at the Society for Neuroscience meetings, probably won't work. Okay, but most job talks are not in those big, massive rooms. So you could go with black on white. If you choose to do it the other way, do not use red. Okay, red, green, colorblind people cannot read red on anything. All right, do not use pastels and do not use fades. When I say readable from a distance, this actually comes right from a talk on just how to give a good talk. Okay, really, as hard as it is for you to believe, people can't see 14 point. And often there's a small piece of data in a sea of empty space. So use your entire space and make it as easy as possible. I think it helps both you and the listener if every slide has a title, but I would try to use that title to state very clearly and directly what the major finding is. So sometimes I see titles and they're microarray data, okay? Or they're questions. Very, very often people use a question. Does CFTR interact with PP2A? That can occasionally work, but in general, a more direct declarative title helps. I also think it helps at job talks because people feel more free to ask you questions as you go along. Okay? It seems to be, again, part of that rite of passage, let's see how they hold up under pressure. And it's easy to get diverted from your train of thought. And so I find when I practice with people, if I try to really rattle them and they get rattled, often they can look up and read the title and know where they were. Again, that's going to be different styles. I know Scott Morgan teaches a lot of workshops, and he tells you to build mystery in your titles. I actually think most scientists are too busy to get mystery and really just want to be given the bottom line, but I know his approach works for many, many people. So again, that's just my opinion. I already talked about this, so I'm not going to spend any time on it. And I do want to address two things because I've seen it really hurt people on job interviews. This is a time where you want to bring extra data. This is a time if someone doesn't understand a piece of your data from earlier, you quickly want to get to it. So if your slides are over animated and you have to hit 30 times to get through it, you lose some precious time. So I would be careful not to animate too much. Okay? You don't need any elaborate transition from slides, no moving in from the right, from the left, twirling in, none of that. And I think in general, some animation so that you don't overwhelm people with a data slide is a good idea, but use less than normal. The other thing is that it can be very distracting to have to keep getting back to your computer. And at some universities, ones without great AV support, somebody carries in a little LCD projector, and they put it on a table, and they stretch the cord, and you're going to need to say, next slide, next slide, next slide. And so try not to animate too much. Industry is much less, although it's changing some, much less into using PowerPoint for talks. Very often they'll whip out some overheads, and you don't need to do that. Just make it clear that you'll need an LCD projector. But very often, you know, there's no one there to help you. And so it's over here, and you're animating 20 times. So I would keep your animation to a minimum. Many of you will have movies that matter a lot. People need to see the movies. If that's the case, bring your own computer, okay? PCs won't run Mac, QuickTime. An old version of Office won't run yours. Bring your computer and also decide what you're going to do if it won't play. One of the best job talks I've ever seen was someone who brought their own computer, but the adapter didn't work. It was our fault, not their fault, but nonetheless, there was nothing we could do about it. And every time she got to a movie, without making us all feel bad, This is what you would have seen. She just told us what the data were and said, you know, if anybody wants, I'll post these on a website when I get home. Okay? That calm under pressure of knowing what she was going to do went a long way. Rule number 6 is to be engaged and personable. We talked a lot about connecting in the introduction. We talked a lot about body language, and I won't say much about that, except to tell you that practice makes this part a lot easier. Whatever you do, don't read your talk. And a lot of people will tell you memorize the beginning and memorize key transitions and memorize the end. That is great advice. But memorizing the talk in general is really bad advice. So really all you want to do is memorize 2 sentences at the start. Occasionally there's a really hard transition, right? Particularly from one set of experiments to another, and it might be useful to memorize that. And you certainly might want to memorize the last sort of final wrap-up. But don't memorize everything because it really comes off as canned. Try not to turn your back to the audience. Make eye contact with everyone. Okay, and this is something pointed out very, very often. There's this idea that the head of the search committee is the only important person in the room, and that person almost never gets to make the decision alone. Okay, everyone sitting in the room is important. So if you're in an awkward room like this, where I think the wings here are too wide, make a point of connecting with people over there and people over there. Ignore the 1 or 2 people sleeping. Do not let them freak you out. Their baby cried, they watched a horror movie, or they're tired, and it has nothing to do with you. All right? Students, if you are at a liberal arts teaching college, students, well, actually, or a Research One university with students in the audience, they text message. I have received emails in the middle of my talk from someone in the audience, okay? Sent by my iPhone, okay? They often have their computers up. Don't read too much into it. Do your best to get them to pay attention to you, but don't get psyched out about it, okay? And something that I think is hard, because people hate questions, is really warmly and genuinely welcome them. If you are in an industry job interview and one of the business people has a family member with X disease and it sort of triggers a connection and a synapse fires and you get a question, you can go a long way by genuinely welcoming those kinds of diversions. Okay? If you are being evaluated for your ability to teach, which many of you will be, your ability to stop and help someone get back on track is what the search committee is going to be watching. That means really knowing your talk and really being able to come back and forth. But anything that you can do to really warmly welcome questions is a positive thing. I'll make one comment about humor, and that is that everyone's yardstick about what is funny and what is offensive is different. So if you are going to use some humor, only use it if it is really genuinely you. Most of us do not want to stand up in front of a room and tell jokes. If we did, we would be stand-up comedians. Okay? Don't use it if it's not you, and don't use it if it is even remotely on the edge. All right? It is something that can turn everyone off right from the start. An ability to work in a diverse group, an ability to relate to people of all different backgrounds, all different approaches to the world and to science and to life is key in every one of these types of job interviews. And anything that you make a joke and it's just taken wrong by one person, it generates an explosion of emails, and I've seen it happen several times, where I've thought through the actual joke and thought, really, I'm not sure I would have done it, but does it require this amount of explosion? It's really important to think carefully about that. If you use humor to hide your nervousness, do something else to get rid of your nervousness, like practice. Okay, that's a much better way to hide nervousness than humor. And then rule number 7 is to start early and practice. Now you should be going to job talks. My guess is that Walls, often, if you're given 2 choices, a job talk and Walls, you'll go see the famous Walls person. Go and see job talks. See good job talks. See bad job talks. Go with a friend and talk about it. If I was hiring, what do I think about that job talk? One thing to realize is not everyone will model good behavior, okay? People, I mean, if every one of your mentors gave a great talk, we probably wouldn't have this workshop today, all right? So you're going to see lots of bad behavior, but that's what you can learn from equally as a really great job talk. Do whatever you can to see people doing job talks now. And I know many institutes actually have searches going on right now. You should find colleagues outside your field to attend your last practice. Okay? I would hope to see emails out fellow L. And I don't know if it would work, but you need to get people a little farther away. In the fall job series, we'll actually form groups that make a commitment to do that for each other. But you can do it informally, and it really helps a lot to get an outsider's view. Talk to anyone that you can who has served on a search committee. That's harder to do in industry, okay? But again, that fall series will bring people from industry. You can talk to industry people as part of an informational interview and say, tell me about successful job talks in your company. Anything you can do to learn about it. Okay, and I talked about the fall series, so I'll stop plugging it. These are nothing more than a reiteration, and I'm going to skip over it to talk about 2 things, okay, neither of which can be addressed very well in this type of broad forum, but both of which need to have some discussion. So we just spent an hour and a half on formal job talks. You will then, hopefully, be asked to do a chalk talk, and it will either be the second day of a 2-day interview or the next time you come back. Okay, and that chalk talk is very informal and no slides. You are showing that you can think on your feet. You will have a whiteboard or an easel or some overheads. Ask which one so you know in advance. Okay, and that's it. You in front of 15 or 20 people. Something interesting, I have a appointment in Genome, and they invite, I don't think they invite everyone, but they invite a broad number of faculty to the chalk talks. At some universities, it's the search committee only, and it varies, but you can assume it's less than 15 or 20 people. All right. Expect many, many interruptions, and expect vigorous debate. If everyone nods their head, that's not necessarily a good sign. If you can have really good give and take back and forth, don't read that as a negative. Read that as a positive. All right? And everyone is watching you, not only the science. So remember, this is an absolutely critical time to show how good a colleague you're going to be. People are watching how aggressive you are, okay? And I've heard criticism of way too aggressive. The flip side of that is I've heard, I'm just concerned that she's not aggressive enough. He just seemed to agree with everything we said, okay? So you want to back down or modify your approach when appropriate. You want to disagree when it's appropriate to disagree, but give a reason why. No, I believe that animal model is critical, and I'm going to put resources into making it because. Not, well, we just disagree on that. That's later once you got the job, okay? And finally, I think this tells you a lot about the department. So to me, this is actually as useful for you as anything else. So if you're in this chalk talk and people are hard on you, but you really feel nurtured and supported, rest assured that when you got to write your first grant, you're going to get supportive, positive, but critical input. If, on the other hand, there's tension in the room and people are over-the-top aggressive, that's who your colleagues are going to be. And if you don't want an over-the-top aggressive department, it may not be the right place. And hopefully you will all have multiple options and interviews and offers, and you'll get to pick the place. So I think here you learn a lot. There is not the tradition of chalk talks in industry as there is in academia, but there is sometimes a 20 to 30 minute meeting in industry that's informal like this, which is your chance to talk about what you would bring to that research division. So you would talk about your skills and how they might relate. That's very hard to do, and many industry interviews don't involve that because there's lots of IP issues and they're not necessarily wanting to share everything with you up front. So this doesn't happen very often in industry. But when it does, it's the same thing. It's meant to be a give and take. They're watching how you interact. They're watching how you think on your feet. Industry sometimes gets this using behavioral questions in a round table format. So it's not exactly a chalk talk, but you'll be sitting at a table and they'll throw out a scenario. So you have six people and they're working on, three are working on this project and three are working on that, and you don't care about project X anymore. What are you going to do? It's sort of the industry equivalent of a chalk talk. In this case, in academia, though, you are talking about your science. So take control. You walk into the room and put a model up on the board immediately. Do not let somebody else start with a question, because if they start from somewhere where you don't want to go and you stumble early because of that, or you head down the wrong path, you can't get back. So the way you take control here, and the most successful chalk talks I have ever seen, are ones where the person walked in and put a model up on the board, okay? Almost everyone can reduce their science to a model. Think about, it shouldn't be messy, okay? But you don't have to be an artist to put a good model up on the board. Think about colors. I know people who carry markers with them in case the department only has blue and black and they want four colors. Do not bring 20. I saw somebody once try to do too much with the right color, and it seemed more about fumbling with the markers than getting going with the program. So plan and practice how you will start working off that model. But realize that it's going to then, like a ping pong ball, bounce wherever it bounces. And your job is to think on your feet, to engage people, to defend what you're going to do, to see how the people receive that and to respond accordingly. Occasionally, twice now actually, so that's not that often, but I haven't been to that. Well, I've been to probably a dozen or two dozen of these. Occasionally somebody hands handouts, and then all I do is read the handout. And I've noticed that's what everybody else does as well. So if you want to bring a typed up first page of AIMS, I wouldn't give it out at the outset. I might give it out at the end or when you pull it out when you talk to people. But I noticed all of us were just reading this one page, and then I started doodling on it, and the next thing I knew, I had no idea where that chalk talk had went. All right, so I would err on the side of no handouts. When you practice these, you don't want your friends. You don't need a pat on the back, because it's not likely to be, yeah, we love those experiments. Yes, it's likely to be, come on, that won't work. Come on, what are you going to do if that doesn't work? What's your backup and your alternate approach if this doesn't work? So practice with the curmudgeons who are going to ask you that, okay? And make sure you have always thought about that. Okay, worst case, I'm going to try this. Best case, what I just put out there is going to work, and then I'm going to, you know, just run with it. But think about it that way. And I think the best way to get ready for this is to be talking about your future work now. 2 years in advance, if you go to a meeting and you find yourself having lunch or dinner or coffee or walking in the woods, because at Gordon conferences and Keystone meetings, that lots of that kind of thing happens, and you're talking to someone you respect, tell them a little bit about what you see doing in the future and see what they ask you. The closer they are to your field, the more detail you'll be able to give. But see what kind of response you get. And likewise, prepare your, start to think about your grant applications early. That's another way of framing the chalk talk. Someone in a panel discussion I was at recently said the chalk talk was her best preparation for her first grant. And then she went one step further and said, I actually think I got my grant based on one idea that I was given in that chalk talk. So think about them the same. The bull session that you would have before you start to write your grant is not that different than the chalk talk, except in this case you want to impress at the same time. When you have a session to just bounce ideas about your grant, you can go unprepared sometimes. In this case, it's a prepared discussion. One other talk we didn't talk much about is the teaching talk, and I'm going to wrap up with that and then take questions. Some schools will send you a topic. Some schools will let you pick a topic. If they send you a topic, they mean it, and you really cannot negotiate. Okay, so if you would have much rather lectured on monogenetic diseases, not polygenic diseases, it doesn't matter. You got to do what they tell you. Make sure to find out, are these freshmen, seniors, seniors who've taken three cell biology courses, master's students. So I, in this biology search I sat in, went to a teaching talk, and the speaker assumed that they were fairly high-level students, and they were freshmen. And it was just a disaster from the beginning. And other parts of the interview were good enough, I think, to have made sort of the cut of the top three, but the teaching talk completely went wrong. So if you are asked to teach, make sure you know who you are teaching, and you need to decide formal with PowerPoint or informal, engaging your students. And there is a culture to every school. Okay, so there are schools where PowerPoint is unbelievably frowned upon. They teach in small groups, and they want the teacher to engage the students. So if you bring your high-tech PowerPoint, you're not going to be in the running. On the other hand, if they're trying to assess your ability to teach freshman biology with 300 people in the room, and you start out with small group activities that get chaotic, you might be okay, you might not. So you really need to think about whether it's a formal lecture or not. Ask if you need to know. But I think you can learn a lot from the website about the sort of culture of the school. Likewise, high-tech versus low-tech. All right, there are teachers, and everyone develops over time a philosophy about teaching. Some people think PowerPoint is too passive. It's only good for one kind of learner. And so whatever your philosophy is, whatever the school tends to have, is what is sort of, that's the decisions you need to make. There will be administrators and faculty in the back of the room. You are not talking to them. Ignore them. You are talking to the students in the classroom, all right? It is as if you were teaching a class, and that is really hard. It's so much easier to look at the back of the room at the important people. And anything that you can do to engage the students goes a long way. I actually recommend for teaching talks that the person start with a sort of genuine and somewhat personal introduction about themselves. Not I grew up in, and you know, a sort of long one, but some way for the students to decide, let me give him a try, okay? You need to be a little bit more folksy and a little bit more engaging, even if it's a pretty formal lecture. This is a lot harder to prepare for. I think that this is a huge challenge for people who are not teaching all the time. But we have recently introduced our series of Scientists Teaching Science. I would encourage any of you thinking about a job that has a predominant amount of teaching to get involved in that course. And I would talk to undergraduate faculty at comparable institutions. If you are interviewing at a large state school, okay, but not the flagship school, for say, for example, the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, you want to talk to faculty at a comparable school, Okay, getting advice from faculty who teach at Princeton might not be the best advice. All right, so you want to find the right people to get advice from. And I think here, your practice needs to be really different. So unlike the Chalk Talk, where I said find the most curmudgeonly difficult people you can, here I would find some students as close in age to who you are talking to. Okay, and in that case here, it would be postbacks in your immediate surroundings, summer students, whatever you can do to find some young people. You really need to see how they respond. Okay, I've talked a lot about what to do now to get ready, and I think that rather than go through this, I'll take some questions. But I want to end by reiterating one last point. Many people tell me I'm just not a good public speaker, and no one is a good public speaker starting out. And I have seen unbelievably dramatic amounts of growth for small amounts of practice, okay? It does not take unbelievable amounts of effort to pay careful attention to your font size and how you make your slides. It does not take tremendous amounts of practice to work on your transitions and to go from, let me tell you about my data, to let me tell you a story. So start now. Lots and lots is riding on the job talk, without a doubt. And so anything you can do now to prepare is worth your while. And with that, I will stop and take any questions. Certainly, there's got to be a question. Absolutely. Someone will contact you. Almost always, your invitation will come by email, but there will be a follow-up phone call to talk about details. And unless it's a very traditional academic department, I think it's a great thing to ask. So the question was, do you need to lay out the pros and cons in a chalk talk? And I would say in every experiment you're thinking to put out there, you should have already thought about the pitfalls and the alternate approaches, and you should bring that up. Sometimes the people won't want to hear it. They'll say, yeah, let's go on to the next one. That seems doable, but you want to show that you have alternate approaches and ways to get around a problem. Absolutely. Very good point. That's it? Wow. So, I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign. Kapil, and then you.
So the connecting chalk talk question would be, do you go step by step with your priorities of your future project? So you start with the first project, and then you say, that's it, and I want to start talk about the second project. So how do you lay it out?
So the biggest mistake that you can make on a chalk talk is sharing your grandiose plans. What you want to share are your modest plans. That said, I hope you all have grandiose plans, because there's lots of problems out there in science, and we need people willing to tackle. Do not lay out, this is my first project, and this is my second, and this is my third, and this is my fourth. Because then, just like a study section uses the word unfocused, overly ambitious, everyone walks out of the room and says, unfocused, overly ambitious. You put out your meat and potatoes project, make sure one element of that is pretty big and exciting, and maybe if pushed, if it's going really well and everyone says, well, we have 15 minutes, you might say, you know, I'm very realistic and I know everything in the next few years is going to focus on what I just presented you. But I am going to share my dream second grant, okay? And then you put it out there. But one of the biggest mistakes is, here's my first R01 and here's my second R01 and here's my third. So keep it somewhat narrow. You had a question.
Yeah.
So I would say two things. The first is the minute you get into that room, you get that basic model up. And you've already, you've drawn it out five times in other rooms, in other environments in practice. So you know exactly how it's going up there. Get that on the board as quickly as you can, all right, so that you're not turned drawing while people are talking. Then turn around, and whatever you do, when you go back to the model, as soon as you make whatever addition or change, turn back. And I would encourage you, anybody supervising undergraduates at this point, summer students or postbacks, anyone, I would encourage you, when you're working with them in preparation for this, instead of using sitting at a table and you're drawing on paper for them, just go out to a whiteboard in the hall and start doing it. And you get really, really good at writing and turning, writing and turning. But it takes practice. And I think the best way is to do it while you're mentoring people now in the lab. So I have never seen anyone write down their list of aims. I think you could do it, but I don't think it would be all that effective. I have seen people do things like cell culture models, animal models, translational, future directions. So big, bolded sort of keywords, for all of the mystique of chalk talks, really what matters is how you engage people and not so much what you write down or don't write down. So you want to get really good at talking about science in short sentences. My first aim will be this. And literally two more sentences before you stop. Other questions? So you will get an email from Lori asking for an evaluation. It will be very helpful. We're really trying to come up with a full job search series. And so any input you can give us would be helpful. I hope to see you again and have a very good summer.